AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's not Matt McNeil. It's Brett Johnson filling in for Matt on a Monday afternoon. I'm back in the hosting chair for just one day today, as Matt is off today, but he will be back tomorrow. Lots of news, of course, to cover today. We have the opening day of the Derek Chauvin trial. We also have some other news to get to, but I do want to start things off by going to our legal expert, Jack Rice. He is an attorney, former CIA analyst, has worn many hats over the years, including hosting some shows on AM 950, as he's going to walk us through what he saw today and the opening day of the Chauvin trial and how both the prosecution and the defense have done so far. Jack Rice, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Well, Brett, I'm happy to do it. Thanks for having me on the program.
Absolutely. So I want to start off with the opening statements and the prosecution, because to me, they laid out a very thorough case walking through the entire timeline of what happened to George Floyd. And I think they really went out of their way to try to knock down one of the defense's arguments that we're probably going to hear. And that's the fact that, well, the drugs in George Floyd's system contributed to his death. But I thought the prosecution did a good job laying out the fact that, well, if someone were really dying from an opioid overdose, it typically wouldn't look like what we saw from George Floyd. So talk a little bit about what you saw from the opening statement by the prosecution.
Let's start with the prosecution. The state's decision to use the prosecutor that they did use, I think, was a really, really smart choice. Jerry Blackwell is a very, very good lawyer. And we have to understand who Jerry Blackwell is. Jerry Blackwell is not with the Attorney General's office. In fact, he's not even a prosecutor. In fact, what he is he is a civil lawyer, but an extraordinarily good civil lawyer. And so Keith Ellison, or whoever it was that made the decision to bring in Jerry Blackwell, although I know that he was advising the Attorney General's office previously, to bring him in on the opening, I think was really smart. He's low-key. He's thoughtful. He's a big picture, so he thinks about things from a historical standpoint, first of all, and so he can think about it in that sense, and then he can deliver that issue. And if we also add this additional piece, because I think it is important, he is a person of color. As a black man, to stand there and talk about this case, I think adds an element that I think is necessary, because one of the things the defense tried to do is they tried to make the argument that this isn't political, this isn't about social change. And the response is, that's simply not the case. You can't deny the reality of the politics on the ground, especially not just of what happened, but we can go back 400 years and talk about the police and black men in this country and what has happened. So I think it was critical in that sense. But if we look at what it was that Jerry Blackwell delivered, he was slow, he was methodical, he worked his way through this trial, worked his way through this evidence, including demonstratives. What I mean by that is he brought up things from the autopsy report and used them in his opening. But what he did first and foremost is he showed that 8-minute and 46-second trial videotape. And I think that was critical because it is the most important, the most powerful, the most legally significant, but I think the most viscerally gut-wrenching of all of the evidence that the prosecution has. And so when he laid that out, what it did was it laid out not just the groundwork for where they were going, but really the underlying fear and the visceral nature of this case to drive this jury to make the decision that he wanted them to make.
So now let's turn things around and look at the defense's opening statements. They tried to emphasize the fact that, well, this case is more than what you're just going to see on that video of just over 8 minutes. They also made some interesting arguments talking about how the crowd could have contributed to Chauvin's behavior. They, of course, talked about how there were drugs in George Floyd's system. Talk a little bit about what you saw from the defense's opening statements.
If we think about what the defense is trying to argue here, I don't want to say it's simple, but it is to some degree. In the end, what Jerry Blackwell said was, it was Derek Chauvin who killed George Floyd. It is that simple. What we know is that from a defense perspective, their argument was different and even slightly more nuanced. What they were trying to argue, what they were trying to explain was it was a combination of things, including George Floyd's behavior on this date. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he was aggressive and fighting back with the police and not listening and pushing back against them, that was a piece of it. The fact that he had serious heart conditions, which he was aware of, and those actually came out, and specifically the fact of the fentanyl and the methamphetamine in his system, all of those things in combination created an environment that resulted in George Floyd's death. In fact, this was really a setup for what's coming down the road when there's going to be multiple medical exams that will come in, essentially autopsy reports that will talk about what killed George Floyd. But in a very simple fashion, what the defense was arguing was George Floyd killed George Floyd. Derek Chauvin did not.
And that's where I want to question you on this right here, because I have some trouble understanding exactly what the statute is right now in Minnesota in terms of what would happen if George Floyd did have drugs in his system. The way I thought I understood the statute was that even if Floyd did have drugs in his system, if Chauvin kneeling on his neck even contributed to his death, wouldn't that still be enough for him to be found guilty even if he did have drugs in his system? If that kneeling on his neck contributed to his death, wouldn't that be enough for him to be guilty?
An excellent point you make, my friend, because that's in fact what Jerry Blackwell was talking about too. The difference is really this, is that what the defense is trying to argue here, is trying to motivate and convince a jury of, is that if we can show sort of all of the things that George Floyd did that contributed to this, that made this what this was, they're trying to convince them to say, but for George Floyd's behavior, this never would have happened in the first place, and that in itself should be enough. That's their argument. It's an uphill climb because of that piece. And in fact, it's going to be easier to prosecute and convict on the third-degree murder charge and on the manslaughter charge than it will be on that second-degree unintentional murder charge because of some of the standards. It's that causation piece that makes it harder for the prosecution at that level. But those other two charges don't have the standard that first charge has.
Well, another argument we saw made by the defense is that, well, Derek Chauvin was behaving the way that he was trained by the Minneapolis police. Are there any legal protections that could possibly absolve Chauvin of responsibility for Floyd's death?
Well, I would rather put it like this, and this is one of the problems that the city has, the city council has, and the prosecution does have in this case. Because what we know is this. This technique was problematic. We know that there are a lot of places in Minnesota and across the country that have outlawed this technique. We know that too. We also know that as soon as this case came about, the Minneapolis City Council outlawed this technique. The Minneapolis Police Department outlawed this technique. And the state of Minnesota outlawed this technique. And so the problem that the state has, and I watched Jerry Blackwell try to thread this needle, is that he's going to talk about how fundamentally dangerous this is. What the defense is going to do is they're going to say, we agree. We completely agree with you. In fact, it's outrageous. But the problem is if you're a Minneapolis police officer and your job is to apply the techniques that the Minneapolis Police Department suggests and allow you to apply, it's a judgment call that you can make under sometimes very volatile circumstances. You don't get to have it both ways by saying, well, we hate this thing, but we allow this thing, and we hate that you use this thing, but we allow this thing. So it's going to be one of those issues where Derek Chauvin can actually potentially use the policy of the Minneapolis Police Department as a shield for himself to say, if you didn't want us to use this technique, then why didn't you outlaw it in the first place?
And I suppose expanding on that, that's going to make the testimony we're going to have later on in the trial from Chief Arredondo and then also Lieutenant Johnny Mercel, who is with the Minneapolis Police Department and is someone who is in charge of their use of force training coordinator. I suppose that's going to make their testimonies very significant later on in the trial.
Oh, huge. And it's great that you're making that point, because if we think about Arradondo and we think about the senior supervisors within the Minneapolis Police Department, my response, if I'm defending Derek Chauvin, again, as you know, I'm a former prosecutor. I've been a criminal defense lawyer in this town for a very long time. I've tried a lot of cases in this city. Is that if we think about this, I go at those guys with both fists. Because my response is, it's all well and good that you get to sit up here now with your bright, shiny badges and point at this guy and say what he did wrong and how he was wrong, when this entire time, throughout your entire careers, when you had the opportunity to overturn this technique, to not use this technique against anybody, black, white, or otherwise, you chose to turn your head. Now, all of a sudden, when it's convenient for you, well, how hypocritical is that? And I think you have the ability to sort of ride your high horse on the defense side in very few places in this trial when you have the ability to do that. The problem is that what this has the potential of doing, this has a potential of pushing the blame at the city and at the Minneapolis Police Department. And in fact, if we think about the agreement that was made between the city council, this $27 million agreement that was made with the Floyd family, my response, if I'm defending in a case like this, is to say there's a reason you settled in this case. And the reason you settled wasn't because of what Derek Chauvin did. Well, it's because the idiocy of the Minneapolis Police Department. And that provides shelter. It provides, again, that shield. So that's what makes this a bit complicated.
So really, in essence, is the best defense strategy of Chauvin just to throw the city of Minneapolis and the police department under the bus, saying this was the problem of how I was trained, and as you were talking about mixed messaging on how you can use this force, is that almost their best strategy, you would think?
Absolutely. I would be all about that. What you do is you blame the city. If this was so horrible, if this was so bad and this was so dangerous, then tell me, why would you not just say, well, you know, we don't want you to use it, but if you have to use it, no. It was available. We were trained on it. We were supposed to use this. And what you get to do is you get to bring in experts of your own, but you get to spend a long time talking about police policy in general and in Minneapolis to say, not about this technique, but about any technique, and say, you apply techniques because they allow for certain types of behavior by your police officers. You have vetted these techniques? Yes. You have allowed these techniques? Yes. And you allow these techniques because it's not just about the safety of the officers, right? Yes. But also for the safety of the people on the streets? Yes. And you work your way through them to really buttress the importance of all of the techniques generally that the city has okayed, has put their stamp of approval on. Now, once you get that, you say, this was one of those techniques. This was a technique that you were aware of. This was a technique that you knew was being applied. This was a technique that you knew that was being applied in your city under your watch, and you still allow this technique, just like all those other techniques that you say are designed to protect the people and designed to protect police officers. That's something that they're going to have a hard time wiggling out of if the defense team does this right. I'm not sure if they're going to do it right, but if they do, they should be able to really come across and strike a couple of blows of their own, so to speak.
We're speaking with Jack Rice. He is an attorney and legal expert, as he, of course, has been following the Derek Chauvin trial, as that's what we're talking about right now. So obviously, the video recordings of what we saw happen to George Floyd are certainly going to be played a lot and referenced a lot during the trial. Now, to me, the video looks pretty cut and dry that Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd. But could there be anything in those video recordings that the defense could use to try to bolster their case?
Yeah, there's no question. And in fact, that's one of the things that the defense was trying to do during openings, right? The idea of making the argument that when you had people becoming increasingly angry, getting increasingly close, the potential of the threat that may cause to divert attention to them and away from the scene, the ability to miss what you might have otherwise been able to see, to say that, understand that the chaos that was in place, it was so chaotic that to assume that this was being done in isolation, in sort of a vacuum-packed room that you could clearly see everything that was going on. That wasn't the case. There were people moving in and out and screaming and cursing and everything else at these officers. That this was a part of what was going on. That's one piece. A big part of this is going to be about George Floyd not being cooperative about getting out of the car, not being cooperative about being put in the car, using his body, using his size, being in excess of 6 foot, 223 pounds, Derek Chauvin, 5 foot 4, 5 foot 9, 145 pounds. They were specific about putting that in. The purpose is to try to lay out that when George Floyd started pushing back, and he not only ignored the lawful orders of a police officer, he used his body against the officers themselves. Those are actually gross misdemeanor charges of obstruction with force. If you get somebody who obstructs with force, how much more force do you need to use? And if they continue to push back, how much more force can you use? This is that use of force continuum that they were talking about. All of these are issues that the defense will try to use. I'm not sure if they'll be successful or not, but they will try to use to make the point that this isn't as simple as you think. This 8 minute and 46 second video isn't the whole story. And in fact, if you start picking it apart rather than looking at it big picture, you're going to find there's a whole series of things in this report that may be very troubling for George Floyd, if you want to put it that way, and not just for Derek Chauvin.
Now, going back to something you were talking about just a few minutes ago, how the defense might try to make the argument that the gathering crowd could have possibly impacted the behavior of Derek Chauvin and his use of force in that situation. If I'm a juror sitting there, this is just me sitting here as a non-legal expert, my reaction would be, you got to be kidding me. How can you possibly say that the crowd was posing a threat? How might the defense make that argument? And then expanding on that, how might the prosecution try to counter that, saying, well, no, the crowd really wasn't a threat whatsoever?
That's great. You're right. But what I'm saying was, that's what the defense did during their openings. You saw it too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, that's the problem. Is it? You're making this argument that these people are saying he can't breathe. You can see he can't breathe. He's dying right there. I mean, this is, you're saying it over and over and over again. And the question is if you're questioning the authority of a police officer, is that obstructing with an officer? If you're telling an officer that they're killing somebody on the street, are you threatening an officer? Explain that to me. And I think that's really where the prosecution team will come back and say, that's not how this works. Is there anybody who used force against any of these officers on the street? And the answer is no. Is there somebody who tried to push anybody off of anybody? Anybody who actually threatened to hurt an officer, to punch an officer, to do anything physically to an officer? And I didn't see it in the videotape. So your problem is that argument really doesn't hold water. I think the best they're going to get was, you don't know in a volatile situation what's coming at you. And if someone is screaming at you, you have to divert your attention, at least to some degree, to watch what they're doing, to watch their hands, to watch their demeanor, to watch for weapons. So you're not just standing there looking straight down. You're looking around because it's also about being on the defense. And so that's, I think, where the defense in this case will try to make that argument.
And final topic I want to go through with you on, Jack, is the testimony we saw earlier today from the 911 dispatcher, Jenna Scurry, who I thought made some pretty powerful statements saying that, well, she generally never calls the supervising officer when there's a situation that she might be questioning. She basically said that she was very concerned about what she was seeing on the video recordings or on the live video from the camera. And she was also saying that, well, I thought the video was almost frozen for a second. Those, to me, seem like some pretty powerful statements that she was making, saying that, well, this was the first time she ever had to call a supervising officer for that very type of situation.
Yeah, I thought she was incredibly credible. I really do. When you watched her, I thought her demeanor was dead on. I didn't think she was over the top. I didn't think she had some sort of axe to grind here. I think she was a professional trying to do her job as best that she could, and that she had real experience, and she just told you what she thought. And I think those are the kinds of witnesses that are powerful in the minds of jurors because they like them. they believe them. And when they say something, you're like, yeah, I see what you're saying. So I think that that's the kind of witness, if they have more of those and they can line those up, this may be more problematic as time goes on.
Yeah, that's an interesting way you put that, because I had that feeling, too, as I was watching part of her testimony and listening to it, is that she seemed very matter-of-fact and straightforward and not like she had any sort of agenda to grind, which I think, as you said, that's exactly what you want the jurors to hear.
Yeah, I mean, all I know is that it's all about credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get somebody who can stand up and look you in the face and say, look, this is what I saw. This is what I thought it meant. And it's clear that you're not trying to get to an outcome. You're just trying to be as honest as you can with what you have at the time. And you can get out something like that. I think people will respect it. They'll listen to it. And when you say something, it gives you a lot more credibility. And when you lose that credibility is when all of a sudden you've decided that, and frankly, I would argue this is true on either side. You get somebody who's decided that no matter what, Derek Chauvin is going down. The problem is you take the stand and that's your demeanor and that's where you're going versus let me tell you what I know and you decide what you do with this. There's power in that, because the fear is that if you have an outcome, whether it's Derek Chauvin is going down or whether Derek Chauvin should walk, you decide which. The problem is that the perception that people will have is colored by your motivation. And so the fear is that your arguments, your statements, your beliefs will be colored by your opinions rather than saying, let the chips fall where they may.
We've been speaking with Jack Rice, of course, a defense attorney, also former host here on AM 950. You can learn more about him at jackrice.org, as he's been kind enough to sit in with us and talk a little about what he saw in the Derek Chauvin trial from today. Jack, appreciate you running long with me today and talking through this case right now.
Happy to do it. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks again, Jack. We'll take a break and come on back with more here on the Matt McNeil Show. Again, Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil here on a Monday afternoon.